We would like to send out a special thanks to the fun and challenging Best Fiends for sponsoring The Trail Went Cold. Best Fiends is the binge-worthy mobile puzzle game. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the episode. June 29th, 2001. Marysville, Ohio. After completing her shift at the Honda Automotive Plant, 29-year-old Patty Atkins clocks out in order to leave on a trip to Canada with her boyfriend. When Patty fails to return after a week and a half, she is reported missing, but her boyfriend denies the trip took place or that he was even involved in a relationship with Patty. It turns out this man was married, and Patty had been paying him large sums of money during their affair, but even though investigators find him to be suspicious, there is not enough evidence to make an arrest, and no trace of Patty is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week we're going to be exploring an unsolved missing persons case, the 2001 disappearance of Patty Atkins. This story was once featured on an episode of the true crime show Disappeared, and I've received numerous requests to cover it on the podcast over the years. The case involves a divorced single mother who told everyone that she was planning to take an extended vacation to Canada with her boyfriend, but vanished without explanation after her shift at a Honda plant came to an end. Patty's sisters and closest friends were aware that this man Patty was involved with was already married, but she seemed certain that he was going to divorce his wife and start a full-time relationship with her. However, major alarm bells went off when Patty failed to return from this so-called vacation, and her boyfriend attempted to deny that they were even in a relationship to begin with. The investigation would reveal a lot of reasons to become suspicious of this guy, and he certainly had a motive to make Patty disappear. But while there was some evidence to indicate that she had become a victim of foul play, the authorities did not believe it was strong enough to charge anyone with murder. On the surface, this does seem like one of those missing persons cases where everyone has a pretty good idea what happened, but feel powerless to do anything without the victim's body. But even so, there's still a lot of nagging, unanswered questions about how exactly these events played out. Since we recently passed the 20th anniversary of Patty's disappearance, I thought now would be an ideal time to finally put together an episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Patty Atkins. Our story begins in 2001 in Marysville, Ohio, a town located in Union County which had a population of around 16,000 people at this time. Our central figure is 29-year-old Patricia Ann Atkins, who goes by the name Patty. Patty is a single mother raising her 7-year-old daughter, McKaylee, but she still maintains a good relationship with her ex-husband. She works as a shift supervisor on the assembly line at the local Honda Automotive Plant, which has been her place of employment since she graduated from high school 10 years earlier. After having spent that time working her way up the ladder, she is expecting to receive another promotion sometime in the near future. On Friday, June the 29th, Patty dropped McKaylee off at her ex-husband's house before heading to work for what was going to be her last shift for a while, as the plant was scheduled to undergo an annual one-week shutdown for the 4th of July. Patty was planning to spend that time going on vacation with her boyfriend, so the arrangement was for McKaylee to stay with her father until July the 4th, before she was picked up by one of Patty's sisters, Marcia. McKaylee would spend the rest of the week at her aunt's home in the town of Marion until Patty returned to pick her up on July the 8th. Patty also owned a golden retriever and some cats, and she would leave them to be boarded at a kennel while she was away. Now, the name of Patty's boyfriend has never been released publicly, but to avoid any confusion, I'm simply going to refer to him on this episode as B. B was a co-worker of Patty's at the Honda plant, but he also happened to be married and have children of his own, even though he and Patty had been periodically dating for a few years. The only people from Patty's personal life who knew about this were her two sisters and a couple of her closest friends, and while she acknowledged that the affair was wrong, she said that B's marriage was not a happy one, and he was eventually planning to leave his wife for her. They had apparently discussed their future plans together, and Patty was hoping to have more children with him. Despite her misgivings about the situation, Marcia still agreed to look after McKaylee while Patty left on vacation with B, but Patty said he never provided her with an exact destination, only that they were going to be staying at a remote cabin somewhere in Canada. According to Patty, the area was so remote that it did not have any cell phone service, so she would not be able to call anyone during her time there. Instead of driving herself to the plant for her shift, Patty asked a friend of hers named LaDonna Wolding to give her a ride, as she said she was planning to start her vacation with B immediately after the shift ended and she would leave with him. Oddly, Patty told LaDonna that B had advised her not to bother packing any clothing for the trip, since they could just buy everything she needed when they arrived. In spite of this, Patty had still decided to pack a teal-colored duffel bag and showed it to LaDonna, claiming that she had just bought something at Victoria's Secret and that it was her boyfriend's favorite color, blue. Patty also said that B carpooled with another co-worker and had asked her to clock out a few minutes early and hide under a cover in the bed of his pickup truck before they left. Since their affair was still very secretive, B did not want his co-worker finding out about it, so Patty would remain hidden in the bed of the truck until B dropped the co-worker off, and she would then join him in the passenger seat as they started their drive to Canada. Well, Patty's shift began at 3:30 p.m., and according to the other workers on the assembly line, Patty made it very clear that she wanted everything done and the area completely cleaned by the end of the shift, so she could leave right at midnight. Well, sure enough, Patty clocked out 19 seconds after midnight and was seen heading up a stairwell, but this would turn out to be the last time she was confirmed to be alive. For the next week and a half, no one heard from Patty, but even though she was scheduled to pick up McKaylee from Marcia's house at noon on July the 8th, she never arrived and never phoned Marcia to let her know she would be late. For the next few hours, Marcia left several messages on Patty's answering machine but never heard from her, so she decided to phone the residence of her boyfriend, B. B's wife wound up answering the phone, and when Marcia decided to pose as a potential customer, inquiring about a side business B owned, his wife told her he would come home later that afternoon. Marcia called some of Patty's friends and learned that no one else had heard from her, so she decided to phone B's residence again a few hours later, and this time he answered. When Marcia said she was Patty's sister and asked where she was, B acted like he barely knew her and asked, quote, "Are you referring to Patty from Honda?" Marcia then asked B about the vacation he had with Patty, and he nervously responded that he had no idea what she was talking about. This prompted Marcia and one of Patty's friends to travel to Patty's house, and they discovered that her car was still parked in the garage, and all of her personal belongings and identification were still inside the residence. Strangely, a number of bands ordinarily used to hold together stacks of $100 bills were found in Patty's closet, though there was no actual money there. There was no indication that Patty had ever returned home, and she never picked up her pets from the kennel, so this finally compelled Marcia to contact the police and officially report Patty missing. At around 3 a.m. on the morning of July the 9th, Marcia was very restless and couldn't sleep, so she decided to call B's number again. When his wife answered, Marcia told her that she was Patty's sister and revealed the whole story about how her husband had been conducting a lengthy affair with Patty and they had supposedly gone away on vacation together. After speaking with Marcia for about 15 minutes, B's wife gave the phone to him and he continued to maintain that he barely knew Patty. He asked Marcia a number of questions and the entire call wound up lasting 45 minutes, but he denied having any knowledge about Patty's disappearance. The investigation would soon be handed over to the Union County Sheriff's Office, and needless to say, once they started delving into the details of Patty's alleged affair with B, they became very suspicious of him. According to Patty's friends and family, over the course of a year and a half, she had loaned Bea around $90,000 to help him with the process of divorcing his wife. A check of Patty's finances would reveal that she depleted her savings accounts, took out a second mortgage on her home, cashed in stock, took out cash advances on her credit cards, and she even went so far as to borrow against her 401k retirement fund. Bea and his brother-in-law jointly owned a side auto repair business, and he reportedly told Patty that he needed the money to buy out his share of the business so that his wife would have no legal rights to it when they divorced. Bea also told Patty that he couldn't leave any sort of paper trail for the loan she gave him, or else his wife would find out. This is why Patty always paid him in cash, and likely explained why money bands had been found inside her closet. However, Patty informed Bea that he needed to start paying the money back to her by July, because that's when she had to start repaying her 401k loans or else face penalties. A search of Bea's accounts and financial records showed no evidence that he had received any large payments, so investigators technically only had the third-hand accounts of Patty's friends and family that she had loaned him $90,000. When Bea was questioned, he totally denied Patty's story that they had been planning to take a vacation to Canada and said he did not even own a remote cabin. He also completely denied they were having an affair, maintaining that he and Patty were nothing more than casual co-workers and he did not know her all that well. Curiously, he did say that Patty had once given him a birthday card at work, but he later decided to tear it up for fear that his wife might become jealous if she found it. Bea's wife also did not believe that her husband had been conducting an affair with Patty and said that on the night she went missing, he had left his shift at the Honda plant as scheduled and arrived home at around 2:30 a.m. Since the plant was shut down the entire week, she said Bea spent much of that time working on projects around the house. As you recall, Patty had told her friend that Bea was going to give one of his co-workers a ride home after their shift ended, and the co-worker confirmed this and claimed he never saw Patty. Since Bea's house was about 30 miles away from the plant, he had an additional explanation for why it took him so long to arrive home. He said that he decided to pick up food at a Burger King restaurant, but wound up being stuck in the line at the drive-thru for 45 minutes. Well, investigators spoke to the manager of this Burger King, and he denied that such a lengthy lineup ever took place during that time period, as they only did $18 worth of business between midnight and 1:30 a.m. on June the 30th. He said the restaurant was never that busy during the early morning hours, and the longest amount of time a customer could ever expect to wait was 10 to 15 minutes. In spite of this, Bea's co-worker backed up his story that they had been stuck in the drive-thru together for 45 minutes. Bea gave permission for police to search his residence, as well as his auto repair business, which was located on the same property. They wound up finding a t-shirt for the Hard Rock Cafe in the bedroom, and Bea's wife said that she did not know where it came from. Well, the previous year, Patty had gone to visit her sister Janine in Miami, who claimed that Patty had purchased a t-shirt at the Hard Rock Cafe, which she said was a gift for her boyfriend. She had also once told her sisters that she purchased a Harley-Davidson phone for Bea, and a phone just like that was found at his residence. In addition, the search turned up a letter that Patty had written to Bea, in which she expressed how much she loved him and couldn't wait to be with him. A check of Patty's phone records would also show there was a history of calls between her and Bea's cell phone. Police arranged for a cadaver dog to perform a search of Bea's property, and it wound up picking up Patty's scent at a slab of excess concrete which had been freshly poured next to a barn addition to his auto repair shop. Bea's wife claimed that it was leftover concrete from a construction project which had taken place during the week he was off work, but when police used a backhoe to dig it up, they found nothing. When police performed a search of a storage area in the auto repair shop, they found a tonneau cover, which are typically used to cover the beds of pickup trucks. Bea claimed that he originally purchased it on June the 26th, installed it on the bed of his pickup truck on the morning of the 29th, before removing it 1 week later. According to the shop's manager, the pickup was ordinarily used as a service truck to haul and transport auto parts, which do not require the usage of a tonneau cover. And while Bea rarely ever used the truck to travel to his job at the Honda plant, he was driving it when he worked his shift there on June the 29th. The tonneau cover was taken into evidence for a forensic analysis, and some cat hairs and a very small spot of blood were found on the underside. The hairs were sent to a lab in Texas which analyzed animal hairs, and DNA testing would confirm that they belonged to Patty's cats. However, there were issues with performing DNA testing on the blood sample to determine if it matched Patty, as it was so small that one single DNA test would completely consume it. For this reason, the crime lab warned investigators that testing might not provide conclusive results and advised them to wait until more advanced forensic technology became available. B did agree to take a polygraph test, but the results showed signs of deception, and he would soon quit his job at the Honda plant. An extensive search was performed in the area surrounding the plant, as well as several nearby properties, but it failed to turn up Patty's body. Since no paper trail could be found to indicate that Patty was still alive, she was legally declared dead in 2006. The case would be featured on an episode of Disappeared, which aired in January of 2011, and during their interviews, investigators seemed optimistic that forensic technology might soon be available, which would finally allow them to perform DNA testing on the blood without consuming the entire sample. But I've never heard any indication that this testing has taken place. As for Patty's daughter, McKaylee, she would be raised by her Aunt Marcia and never spoke publicly about her mother's disappearance until 2016. By this point, she was going to grad school at Kent State University and said she had pretty much blacked out the original media circus surrounding the case in order to cope with the sadness. McKaylee believed that her mother would be proud of what she had accomplished and hoped that anyone who had information about the case would come forward. But even though investigators believe that Patty was the victim of a homicide, there has been no trace of her for 20 years, and she continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Best Fiends. We are currently nearing the end of summer, which always provides a good opportunity to reset and rejuvenate ourselves and enjoy a little me time. While that me time can often be enjoyed outdoors, this was a particularly hot summer, and there were some days when I just did not feel like venturing outside my comfortable, air-conditioned abode. Sometimes the best way to reset is by giving yourself a fun challenge, like learning a new language or picking up a new hobby, but when the weather's too hot, one of the most ideal ways to experience this challenge is by playing the super fun Match 3 mobile puzzle game, Best Fiends. I've been playing it for nearly 2 years now and made great progress on it, but the summer has given me ample opportunity to climb even higher, and I'm currently creeping up on level 2000. Seriously, the game is hard to put down sometimes, and I hope to be able to achieve my goal of reaching level 2000 by the end of this month. Since Best Fiends has thousands of puzzles, and they're adding new ones all the time, you can spend 2 years playing the game and beating 2,000 levels without running out of material. Best Fiends is free to download, so you can start solving puzzles right away, and there are tons of cute characters, aka fiends, to collect as you go along. My personal favorite is probably Beebert the Bumblebee, because the fiend is a movie buff like myself, and, well, I've been looking for an opportunity to say Beebert the Bumblebee on this podcast. Summer is a great time to get away from it all, and whether you're unplugging from the internet to hit reset, or just finding yourself without Wi-Fi, you can still enjoy Best Fiends. I love that I can play it literally anywhere I want without having to worry about using data or finding Wi-Fi. In fact, a few weeks ago, my internet went out for several hours, but I was able to pass the time by playing Best Fiends, and I never have to miss out on any of the thousands of fun puzzles Best Fiends has to offer. So download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Give it a try. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So yeah, it goes without saying that this might be one of the least mysterious cases ever featured on The Trail Went Cold. I always go into these cases objectively and try to look at the evidence from all possible perspectives, but here, it's really difficult to come up with any logical theories which don't involve Patty Adkins' boyfriend being responsible for her disappearance. I mean, there are definitely some unanswered questions that are worth discussing, but it's hard to come up with any alternate scenarios which make sense. There's zero chance that Patty ran away voluntarily, since there's been no paper trail for her at all in 20 years, and everyone who knew her said she never would have abandoned her daughter. Yes, theoretically, Patty could have been abducted by an unknown third party shortly after she clocked out at the Honda plant, but there does seem to be physical evidence placing her in her boyfriend's truck, which cannot easily be explained away. It also doesn't look like there was anyone else who would have had a motive to make Patty disappear. Interestingly enough, there is virtually no information out there about Patty's ex-husband, and his name has never been released publicly, but it sounds like they still maintained a good relationship, and I don't see any indication that he was ever considered to be a possible suspect. Since he was looking after their daughter, McKaylee, at the time Patty went missing, he probably wouldn't have even had the opportunity to commit this crime. I mentioned earlier that the name of Patty's boyfriend has never been released publicly by the police or the media, which is why I've referred to him as B on this episode. But if you search hard enough online, you'll be able to find this guy's name, as well as his wife's, as it looks like they are still together after all these years. Some of you might remember the topics forum, which sometimes contained lengthy threads about unsolved cold cases before the forum was shut down in 2018. Of course, because there was very little moderation at topics, these threads sometimes contained a lot of unsubstantiated gossip, rumors, and mudslinging, and the conversations would devolve into dumpster fires. While I never personally got the chance to see it before the forum closed, I have read that topics once contained a lengthy thread about the Patty Atkins case, where B's wife and other members of his family stopped by and made a number of posts in which they supposedly said some nasty things about Patty, calling her a quote-unquote psycho stalker who would not leave B alone. However, the evidence in this case seems to show that these allegations are completely hateful nonsense, as B seemed to content to use Patty by any means necessary. This is far from the only example of this, but sadly, Patty's disappearance just seems to be one of those missing persons cases in which everybody has a pretty good idea what happened, but without a body, the authorities are reluctant to make an arrest. Some might argue that there is enough circumstantial evidence to bring this case to trial, but there's hardly a smoking gun against B, and you just never know what tactics a good defense lawyer might use to generate reasonable doubt with a jury. It sounds like everyone in Patty's life described her as a very kind, generous person, and while the few people who knew about her affair with B warned her that it was a bad idea, Patty was described as someone who just did not like being alone, and she genuinely seemed to believe that B was going to leave his wife and they could make their relationship work. It's a big red flag that Patty supposedly loaned this guy around $90,000 at great financial risk to herself, and I'm sure it's no coincidence that she happened to go missing around the same time she started demanding that he pay back the loan. And to give you an idea of how serious Patty's creditors were, just do a search about this case at newspapers.com, as you'll find a number of editions of the Marysville Journal Tribune from early 2003, where the local Honda Federal Credit Union announced that they had filed a complaint against Patty for unpaid debt she owed, and informed her that she was required to answer the complaint. Seriously, the credit union published this article for 6 straight weeks. As you know, there's nothing more dignified than trying to collect money from someone who's been missing for a year and a half, and was the probable victim of a homicide. Given the financial angle, you have to wonder what B's original intentions were. Was there a point where he legitimately believed that his affair with Patty could evolve into a permanent relationship? Or was this affair nothing more than an elaborate con job orchestrated for the express purpose of scamming Patty out of her money? Patty's financial records confirm that she withdrew a ton of money from her accounts and took out a number of loans and cash advances, but there is no concrete proof in B's financial records that he ever accepted any money from her. It seems obvious that she gave him all these loans in cash, and likely did so over an extended enough period of time that it didn't draw any attention, but what exactly did he use this money for? $90,000 is a good chunk of cash, so it makes you wonder if B had his own personal debts, possibly involving drugs or gambling, which made him desperate enough to bleed money out of Patty. We really don't know all that much about B's background, but investigators have stated that he did not have any known history of violence, and I've never heard anything about him being involved in criminal activity either. So it's pretty unsettling to think that this may have been a calculated plan where he always intended on killing Patty when she outlived her usefulness to him. In retrospect, it definitely appears that the so-called vacation to Canada was an elaborate setup to lure Patty to her death, as B's instructions to her were so odd. He never revealed their exact destination, but he told Patty not to pack any clothing because they could just buy everything when they arrived, even though this place they were going was supposedly so remote that there was no cell phone service. Of course, this would provide a convenient excuse for Patty not to phone any of her friends and family for a week and a half, so that it would take a long time for them to realize she was missing. I know that Patty showed her friend LaDonna a duffel bag full of items that she had packed for the trip, but this bag has never been found. It's also very strange that Bea apparently wanted to leave on this vacation immediately after their shift at the Honda plant ended, even though it was after midnight. If you're traveling from Marysville to Canada, the closest entry point is the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel, which connects Michigan and Ontario, but there's still a 3-hour drive at the minimum, so what's the point of making that trip so late at night? And there's also Bea's bizarre instructions for Patty to hide in the bed of his pickup truck when they left the plant, because he needed to give a coworker a ride home and didn't want him to find out about their affair. Technically, we only know these details about the vacation because of third-hand accounts from Patty's sisters and friends, but if what she told them is true, it worked to Bea's advantage because Patty wasn't reported missing for a week and a half, so he would have had plenty of time to cover his tracks. Now, when Bea was finally questioned about this, he denied that any trip to Canada was ever planned and acted like he barely knew Patty, but of course, gifts she supposedly purchased for Bea were found at his residence, as well as a love letter she had written to him. I mean, I know Bea's wife and family have gone on message boards and attempted to paint Patty as a psycho stalker, but if that was the case, why would Bea have held on to that love letter and not voluntarily told the police about it? If Patty was really obsessed with Bea and she wouldn't leave him alone, why didn't he just say so instead of acting like they were nothing more than casual acquaintances? During the Disappeared episode, one of the investigators is interviewed and states that he found it particularly odd when Bea told him that he had once received a birthday card from Patty but tore it up so that it wouldn't make his wife jealous. If they hardly knew each other, why would Patty give him a birthday card to begin with? So since we're on the subject of Bea's wife, we need to talk about her, as one of the big unanswered questions in this case is how much involvement or knowledge she might have had about Patty's disappearance. From what I've read online, the couple is still together 20 years later, which means that she did not believe the allegations about her husband's affair, or she forgave him for it, or she knew exactly what was going on and was complicit in what happened. Remember, Patty allegedly gave Bea $90,000 in cash, so if this crime was financially motivated, perhaps Bea and his wife were in on it together and came up with this scheme to swindle money out of Patty. One of the biggest red flags in this case occurred when Patty's sister Marcia decided to phone up Bea and his wife at 3 a.m. to inquire about Patty, and their call lasted a total of 45 minutes. Now, let's assume that Bea is telling the truth about barely knowing Patty, and that he and his wife are both completely innocent of any involvement in her disappearance. If a complete stranger phoned you up at 3 a.m. and falsely accused you of being embroiled in an affair with someone, would you remain on the line with them for 45 minutes, or would you just assume this person was crazy and hang up? Both Bea and his wife spend a great deal of time asking questions about Patty and her disappearance, and in hindsight, Marcia believed they were attempting to gauge how much she actually knew about the whole situation. I believe that if most wives received a strange phone call at 3 a.m. accusing their husband of infidelity, they would be a lot more suspicious, but Bea's wife continued to stand by him and openly expressed her belief that he was not having an affair. She also provided Bea with an alibi on the night of Patty's disappearance and accounted for his whereabouts during the following week. If this woman is genuinely innocent and doesn't have any idea what actually happened, then it sounds like she's in some major denial. Now, there has been some confusion about where exactly Bea lived, as some sources out there state that he resided in Canton, about 30 miles away from the Honda plant in Marysville. But in actuality, Canton is located 140 miles away from Marysville, but I've seen other sources state that he lived in Kenton, which is 30 miles away from Marysville. I'm going to assume that Kenton was the correct destination, since 140 miles sounds like a hell of a long commute. Bea's shift ended at midnight, and his wife told police that he returned home at 2:30 a.m., which would make sense if they lived in Canton, since it would take that long to make a 140-mile drive, but if they lived in Canton, the drive home should have taken just over 40 minutes, meaning that there's a lot of extra time which isn't accounted for. So I guess this might explain why B elected to provide one of the most ridiculous alibis I've ever heard in a criminal case by claiming that he stopped off at a Burger King and was stuck in line at the drive-thru for 45 minutes. Obviously, the Burger King manager debunked this, but even at their peak hours, no fast food restaurant is going to be busy enough that you're trapped in line waiting for an order for 45 minutes, let alone during the early morning hours. It's very likely that B was using this time period to dispose of Patty's body, and once his wife told police that he returned home at 2:30, he had to fabricate a cover story to account for why it took him 2.5 hours to complete what should have been a 30-mile drive. But what's truly bizarre is that the boyfriend's co-worker corroborated his story about the 45-minute wait at the drive-thru, which suggests that he might also be involved in what happened. Now, this guy's name has also never been released publicly, and there's zero information out there about him, so I cannot imagine what his motivation would be to lie like that unless he was complicit. But without knowing anything about him or his association with B, I can't judge whether he would be the type of person willing to participate in a murder and the disposal of a dead body. However, his potential involvement could mean that along with B and his wife, a total of 3 people might know what happened to Patty. Even without a body or much in the way of physical evidence, investigators could conceivably make an arrest if the wife or the co-worker decided to talk, but if they were involved, they both managed to keep their mouths shut for 20 years. Now, let's talk about the evidence they do have, which include a small drop of blood and hairs from Patty's cats, which were found on the tonneau cover for the bed of B's pickup truck. There has been a lot of ambiguity about whether that blood will be subject to DNA testing, since a single test could completely consume it. Back when this case was featured on Disappeared, investigators stated they were hopeful that forensic technology had improved enough since 2001 that they would soon be able to perform DNA testing, but this episode aired 10 years ago. In January of 2018, this case would be profiled on an episode of the true crime show Crime Watch Daily, and when asked about the blood evidence, both the Union County Sheriff and prosecuting attorney stated they would not reveal any information about it at this point. Well, even if by chance the blood did match Patty's DNA, that's hardly a guarantee that a murder conviction would take place. You might recall the episode I released 2 years ago about the 2001 disappearance of Michelle Harris, another presumed homicide victim whose body has still never been found. Her estranged husband Cal Harris was convicted of her murder based largely on some tiny specks of blood which were found inside his garage. But his conviction was overturned, and he wound up going on trial a total of 4 times until his defense team asked for a bench trial. A judge finally decided to find Cal not guilty, as those specks of blood were just not strong enough evidence to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So who's to say the same thing wouldn't happen if B went on trial for Patty's murder with the evidence they currently have? I can definitely understand why the local prosecutors have been reluctant to charge him, as they would not get another opportunity if he was found not guilty. However, I'd argue that the presence of the cat hairs on the underside of the tonneau cover is a lot more compelling than the blood evidence, and until I researched this episode, I honestly had no idea there were labs out there which could use DNA testing to match hairs to a specific animal. Since Patty dropped off her cats at a kennel right before she went to work at the Honda plant, it's been theorized that some of their hairs might have gotten attached to her clothing or body, and she transferred them onto the tonneau cover when she hid underneath it in the truck bed later that night. This is evidence which directly places Patty in that truck, and it's really hard to come up with an innocent explanation for it. The tonneau cover was not actually purchased until June the 26th, and by his own admission, B didn't install it on the truck until the morning of the 29th, the same date Patty went missing. That's a very limited window of time in which Patty could have transferred those cat hairs. But would the cat hair, combined with the compelling circumstantial evidence, be strong enough to prove B's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt and secure a conviction? It's really hard to say. These days, we are seeing more people get convicted of murder without a body, but these cases generally require very strong evidence that a crime took place, and we just do not have that here. Unfortunately, since Patty was not reported missing for nearly 9 days, B would have had a lot of time to cover his tracks and dispose of evidence. It's interesting how a cadaver dog seemed to hit on Patty's scent on a slab of concrete on the boyfriend's property, which had apparently been poured during the same week Patty was supposed to be on vacation. While an excavation turned up nothing, I have to wonder if perhaps Patty was originally buried there at some point, but B became paranoid and decided to dig her up and move her to another location. A horrifying theory I've read online is that hiding over the tonneau cover may have actually been the direct cause of Patty's death. During a thread about this case on Web Sleuths, a poster wrote that they had once seen this warning written on a tonneau cover's installation instructions. Quote, "Never allow people or animals to occupy the bed of a truck while the engine is running. Serious or fatal injury may occur from carbon monoxide poisoning or collision," end quote. Well, I actually did some research on this and came across a 1992 article from the Washington Post with the headline, "Poison from Pickup Trucks." It explored the potential safety issues with placing kids or animals into the bed of a pickup truck covered by a tarpaulin or a shell, as this could potentially expose them to lethal doses of carbon monoxide. They cited cases in which children had been brought into medical centers to treat accidental carbon monoxide poisoning after they lost consciousness while riding in the back of a covered pickup truck. So this very well could have been a calculated plan on B's part, as being underneath a tonneau cover for a prolonged period of time may have caused Patty to succumb to or become seriously incapacitated from carbon monoxide poisoning. This may have allowed him to kill Patty without inflicting much physical violence and left very physical evidence behind in his truck. But regardless of whether Patty was the victim of a violent attack or carbon monoxide poisoning, it was still premeditated murder, no matter which way you look at it. Whatever B did, it's a travesty that he has managed to get away with her disappearance and go on living his life with his own family for the past 2 decades, while Patty's family have been forced to live without her. Patty's daughter McKaylee, who is currently in her 20s, agreed to appear on camera to be interviewed during the aforementioned Crime Watch Daily episode, and she came across as such a strong, level-headed young woman that the interviewer, Anna Garcia, actually broke out into tears over the idea that McKaylee had to grow up without her mother. So McKaylee and the rest of Patty's loved ones definitely deserve to find her body and bring her home and witness the perpetrator or perpetrators face justice. So if you happen to have any information on the disappearance of Patty Adkins, please contact the Union County Sheriff's Office at 937-645-4110. That's 937-645-4110. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the bizarre 1934 ransom kidnapping of June Robles, who was found alive inside a metal box in the desert, but her kidnappers were never caught, and there's been some debate about whether the whole thing might have been an elaborate hoax. I'm also going to be dropping the occasional exclusive bonus Patreon episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, and we recently released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the unsolved disappearance of convenience store clerk Deborah Poe. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Jay Bevan, Heather G, Stephen M, Louise M, Diane D, Ava P, and Jonathan D. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another podcast, Appalachian Murder, Mystery, and Legend.
Appalachia. Appalachia is a very distinct word, and everybody has their own opinion of what it represents. Moreover, though, whether right or wrong, it stirs up images of everything from indescribable mountaintop beauty to deep forests and cabins in the wood, or maybe even trailer parks, meth heads, extreme prejudice, and xenophobia. The fact that one word can bring up such a huge response is an ode to its far-reaching influence in society. The Appalachian Mountains are the oldest mountains in the world. They once towered 30,000 feet into the air and currently stretch from Canada through 14 states all the way to Louisiana. The inhabitants of these mountains, though the many years of their existence, have lived through and witnessed what can only be described as horrendous, demeaning, and even downright unbelievable. History, as we are now learning every day, is not exactly what we've been told, and what was once thought to be nothing more than fairy tale is now coming to light as truth. I often hear references to the movie Deliverance or people making funny banjo sounds when describing the Appalachians. I, being born and raised in these mountains, know that nothing in fact could be more wrong, or in some cases more right. The history that lies in these mountains is rich and has been around longer than any place in the United States. In fact, far longer than the United States itself. Hello, I'm Larry Bentley. Join me in my new podcast called Appalachian Murder, Mystery, and Legend. Come with me on a fantastic journey through these mountains where we will explore Appalachian life, mysteries, legends, and history such as the true story of the wreck of Old 97, or the first recorded serial killers in America, Big and Little Harp, just to name a couple of episodes. That's Appalachian Murder, Mystery, and Legend, available right now on your favorite podcast media. I can guarantee it's not going to be anything like you think. Thank you.
As you probably know, I am hoping to appear at CrimeCon UK in London at the end of September, though it's still up in the air at this point whether travel restrictions will allow me to make the trip. But if not, I'm pleased to announce that The Trail Went Cold has been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to get a discount. So to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge, please visit CrimeCon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. That's CrimeCon.com, and the promo code is TRAIL. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.